economics training as you have. But that sometimes, you know, given the way the world is going, is not necessarily a bad thing at all. Considered to be quite cautious, an unusual choice for President Trump, etc. And apparently he got the news. He loves cycling, rough riding, if you know what I mean, on those rugged bikes. He was on a trail when he got the information, but decided to complete the trail before making himself available for higher things. Interesting, though. It's a lesson to all of us. Let's not get too stressed out. World carries on without you. To come back to yourself, then, Advocate van der Merwe, shall we carry on, then?
Thank you, Jim. The next question still relates to the issue of rehabilitation. If we compare with sequestration, there is an interest implication. The person must not just pay back the debt as of the date of the order of sequestration. There's also an interest component. So the question comes, in respect of this debt intervention, if the person has been rehabilitated, should we require the consumer to only pay back the debt as on the date of application? Because remember, we stop the charges, etc., from the date of application. Or should we include interest? And if we do include interest, my proposal would be that we do not decide on the interest rate here, but that we require the minister to prescribe the interest rate. But the question is more, should there be interest added? And, of course, if it is from the date of application or from the date of the order. So that is a question that was held over for the committee to discuss.
All right. I remember even before I left, this was coming up every now and again. When should this be from? And also the abuse of these things, etc. Any comment from anyone in the committee? Remember, you're representing people of South Africa, all of you, huh? They're relying on you to come up with these things. You see, if you unpack that a little bit, and you just say that again, please, because it's a serious point, actually.
Thank you, Chair. If we compare, first off, with sequestration proceedings, for a person who has been sequestrated to be rehabilitated by paying back the debt that was subject to the sequestration order, there is an interest attached. So it is not just the debt at the time of the sequestration order that must be repaid back. There must also be an interest amount added to that and paid to the credit providers. So that is how sequestration works. It's not to say that that is how debt intervention should work, but the question comes, if the consumer who has received the debt intervention wants to rehabilitate him or herself, should we only require that they pay back that amount that was the subject of the application? Or should we say, in order to rehabilitate yourself, in other words, you are now doing something before the orders expire, so you don't want to wait the 24 or the 36 months, you want to be rehabilitated now, should you just pay back the amount that was the subject of the debt intervention, or should an interest amount be added to that?
You know, why should you be penalized if you're going to pay it back earlier? I mean, on the other hand, here's a hand. Right.
Thank you, Chair. There is an opinion that they should include the interest. It's not like you're being penalized. Remember, your debt's been written off, and now you've come into your circumstances have changed. So you want to be treated equally like everybody else in South Africa. So if you want to be treated equally like everyone else in South Africa that hasn't received debt relief, then you should pay the interest like everybody else in South Africa in order to be rehabilitated. That's my opinion.
sounds very reasonable, don't you think? Does it sound very reasonable?
Yes.
Right, then we come to the second aspect, which said the interest rate, should it be flat or should we leave it for the minister? Isn't that right to determine? So it's a two-part. And shall we leave it for the minister to determine? Right, there we are. So that was very quick. Let's move on. And just before that, I'm sorry I referred to you as that young man. Of course, I'm thinking of my 70-odd years. It's Mr. Roy Hoverman, isn't it? Yes. And you're in National Treasury down there, very soberly dressed. Yes. Right. Carry on, Lee.
Thank you, Jen. The next question was whether in this rehabilitation, we're still busy with rehabilitation, should the credit provider be given an option to object to this application? The subcommittee discussed this and decided that, no, what we should rather do is to require the consumer to bring proof that the credit providers were paid in full. Because if everyone is paid in full, then they qualify for the rehabilitation. So then you don't need the credit provider to be given an opportunity to object. So what we have done is to require the consumer to notify the credit provider of his or her intent, and then to provide a letter. I just want to see where I've got it there. It is on page 20 at the bottom, subsection 3A. So the application for rehabilitation must be supported by a letter from each credit provider affected by the order, confirming that he or she received payment in full, or that they reached a settlement agreement and they're happy with the settlement agreement. So if the consumer brings those letters from every affected credit provider, then he or she can be rehabilitated. So that was the discussion there.
On then?
The next one then is the prescribed debt intervention. And the question is not about the drafting. The question is about whether it should be there at all. Now, what we have done with prescribed, it starts on the bottom of page 21. It is very strict. The minister can only prescribe a measure to alleviate household debt, so it must be for household debt, not in relation to business, household debt. Sorry. It must address one of these two economic circumstances. It must be, one of three. Significant exogenous shock that caused job losses. Or it must be a natural disaster. Or it must affect certain people in a certain group, and I'll get to that group now, so that there is no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt for them. So that is kind of what we are doing here. So thinking about maybe a more permanent NINA process that can be put into place. The measure that the minister may make may only be in respect of indigent persons, child-headed households, persons with an income of less than 7,500, persons who suffered an unforeseen loss. And I'm just going to make a note for myself. If it is kept, we need to probably put in the disabled, those kind of lists in here. And it may only be in respect of a maximum interest or fee, suspending, or extinguishing. So the minister is very limited in the type of intervention that the minister can prescribe. If the minister wants to go, in fact, if the minister wants to do it, this is what he or she is limited to, and then he or she must consult the minister responsible for finance, must consult minister responsible for justice, the National Credit the Tribunal, Credit Industry. Then he or she must table a report in the National Assembly so that the committee can be aware of what is going on. Must consult with the National Assembly, which of course will be with this committee. Then must publish a notice in the Gazette saying what will be the requirement. There will be 30 days in which people could comment on it. and then the minister must table a report in the National Assembly. All of these measures were because the committee was concerned about giving the minister almost a blank check to do this debt intervention measure, and the committee understands that doing a debt intervention could have serious consequences for the economy. So the committee felt if the minister does prescribe, there must be strict guidelines within which the minister must operate. So this is the one option, these strict guidelines. The question then arose, but should we not just say the minister must bring a bill if he wants to, rather than allow the minister to prescribe with all of these strict measures, should we just not rather say the minister should bring a bill? On that note, I need to just maybe take the committee back a little bit. This bill started off as only prescribed measures. That was almost where we started, was to empower the minister to prescribe. So that was the thing that kicked everything off, was to allow the minister to prescribe. It has since then developed with a measure actually being determined by the committee. So there have been changes, but I also just think members should keep in mind that that is where we came from. And the concern initially was that the discretion that was given to the minister to prescribe was too broad, just any economic circumstances, things like that. So that is where we came from. So that is a decision to be taken. Should we say that should we empower the minister to prescribe, but we make strict guidelines? And of course, the minister will still have to comment on these guidelines and say, no, but this can't work, what, and it can be tweaked. Or should we just take it out and say, if the minister wants to bring a debt intervention or a debt relief measure, the minister must bring a bill?
Do hear you, but Honourable America?
Yes.
No. All right. You know, you started off, though, by pointing out that, you know, this is quite an onerous sort of process. You've got to do all the consultations, five of them by the looks of things, five ministers from what I can gather, then the Gazette, then the National Assembly. Now, if we want things to take effect speedily, what would be the shorter process? Would it necessarily be a bill? You see, that's one argument, and then you can put this in and off it goes. Or do we go through this prescribed process? So I think the other factor we tried to take into account was the speed and the urgency that this that we may need, and that currently we didn't really have this mechanism or measure. Can you respond to that, Advocate, please?
Thank you, Chair. If the Minister brings a bill, it will have to go through a process in this committee. So that is the one thing that the process that we do prescribe does not envisage. The minister would, with all due respect, even if the minister brings a bill, the minister would have to consult the Minister of Finance, Minister of Justice, National Credit Regulator, Tribunal, Credit Industry, because if the minister didn't, this committee will ask, but have you consulted these people? You're asking us to approve this measure. So it seems onerous because we are stipulating it. But in general, when a department makes or a minister makes regulations, this is the process that they go through. The only thing that differs is the fact of that we require two reports on this process in the National Assembly, but we do not require the Assembly to approve the reports. So it is simply that there must be a consultation. And in general, with regulations, there has been a shift in most bills where the minister is empowered to make regulations. It is said that we include something to say that the minister must consult Parliament. So there is being a consultation process always built into making of regulations for various reasons. But so where in the past a bill would simply say the minister may make regulations, most pieces of legislation now includes a process where those regulations must first be brought to Parliament for consideration and inputs and comments before the minister can proceed. So, it, like I say, it sounds onerous, but this is probably in practice the process that will be followed. The thing that is very onerous is perhaps the criteria that that is set out. And that's why I'm saying that is perhaps something that can be tweaked. But we do provide that if the minister wants to go broader, then he or she can ask the permission from the assembly to go broader. So that could be part of the report process. I do not think that it is necessarily more onerous. A bill has to do public participation process. All of those things will have to happen.
Just a last point. Presumably you're still going to do a bit of a clean-up here because we took out the phrase child-headed households, you know, earlier. So the consequential amendments, crafting amendments, you will implement along the way. Are we all on track then? Yes, Honourable William?
Chairperson, with regard to the intervention to be prescribed, I think that we should just park this, it's quite a big debate on whether or not, it's quite a big part. I think we should keep it within this committee bill, but I do think that it's going to take us a few hours to get through this, what exactly that is going to be like for the minister. So we park it for the moment and just continue with the more agreeable clauses. Yes.
That we're not going to deliberate on it, flagging it as a way for tomorrow. So let's move on then. Are we moving to page 4 of the committee subcommittee report?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get to my notes. Just make sure.
Page 24.
Okay, the what we have here is credit life insurance that becomes mandatory, and I just want to see the right clause now. No. There we go. Yes, it is now the insertion, so it's paragraph B, the insertion of the amount. So what we have is that where a credit agreement exceeds 6 months and the principal debt does not exceed either 50,000 or 100,000, the credit provider and the consumer affected by this agreement must enter into credit life insurance for the duration of the term of the credit agreement. The question that came up here is, if it is for all credit agreements, your problem is that you also start affecting your million rand houses. So then you require everyone, and I think the credit regulator indicated to us that it's per 1,000 rand, it's something like 4 rand 20. So it becomes a large amount that a person will have to pay in addition to the other costs of that credit. The purpose, however, of making it a compulsory thing to include is that the group that you are targeting here, I suppose it would be broader than your 7,500 or maybe 10,000 or so, but most often your poorer consumer will not be incurring a credit agreement of more than the 50 or the 100,000. So that is the target. And by making credit life insurance compulsory, the question of, oh, but do I have credit life insurance on this becomes moot because everyone will have it if that is the type of agreement. If a debt counselor is giving you advice, if the credit regulator considers something, if the Consumer Commission considers something, they know this agreement must be subject to credit life. And then, of course, if there was retrenchments, disability, etc., then that credit life will kick in and the person will be able to pay the debt off. So that is the thinking behind it being mandatory. The question, of course, then is it unlimited principal debt, or is the principal debt 50,000, 100,000? What should the amount be?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the target groups that was emphasized in our deliberations during the course of the morning are basically those who earn, in brackets, 7,500 rand. And we all know that that particular group is also very vulnerable to retrenchments and loss of employment opportunities, etc. Therefore, if we take the principal amount of 50,000 rand, we will exclude a host of people out of that kind of protection. So it is our view that, and the view that was advanced by my colleague, Mr. McPherson, is that we perhaps should have a rather staggered approach in terms of how we wish to provide for insurance against sudden loss of employment and deaths and serious illnesses. And the proposal that we have was advanced by Mr. McPherson is that if we have a principal debt of 5,000 rand, and then we should consider that as you know, eligible amount for insurance, because it's also common that our poorer households will seldom incur debts of 50,000 rand. They will, you know, buy the odd dining room suite and fridge and stove. It will roughly amount to that principal amount. And then as the amount goes higher, then we could look at the different sort of amounts that need to be insured, basically that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate you, you know, once again outlining that argument put forward by the Honourable McPherson. I know that at one point a lot of it was, in fact, I see it's just been referred to here on the overhead. Yeah. Only unsecured proposes sliding scale. He's got a little bit of a question mark here against principal debt. I don't know if he outlined that to yourself as well. Honourable Tierke.
Thanks, Chair. On that same clause, Section 16, when you have a credit agreement insurance and suppose the debt is paid up, and what happened? Do the consumer get the, is it paid back, they get a refund, or what is that? Are you pay insurance for just in case, or when it's paid up, then you forfeit your premiums as it paid, and what is the rationale there?
Yes, Chair, it's definitely it's insurance. I'm just looking at the regulator. So it would be the same as insurance. If you have insurance on your car, if you sell the car, if you know you pay it up, you it is definitely the it is something that you lose. You lose those payments. It is to cover you in case something happens. And that is why, in fact, here on the notes that I've made on the outstanding questions document, that is the credit regulator has indicated that it's capped to 4.50 for every 1,000 rand, so to make sure that it's not not excessive. The problem, of course, just is if you start moving towards millions, that could be a bit of a concern. So if I may also just speak to the proposal by Mr. McPherson. The sliding scale, the question about the principal debt is from me, because he simply indicated agreements up to 5,000 rand. So my question was, is this the principal debt? My only concern on this sliding scale is that if we're in the subcommittee, the discussions almost were the other way around, where you would rather have your 100% cover up to 50,000 or 100,000 and not 100% cover more than 50,000. Because the thinking, if I'm right, was that your poorer group of consumers, you won't necessarily enter into an agreement for 200 or 300 or a million. So the people that you want to protect are more your smaller types of agreement, and that is where you need the 100%. Something, if we do look at a sliding scale, it is something that we need to keep in mind. This is now a proposal from one member. I don't know if the credit regulator might, and DTI themselves might have some inputs on what would be a good way to deal with this. If the committee does want the sliding scale, we could always say the minister must prescribe the percentage of credit life insurance for every type of agreement that is mandatory. So those are our options that we can look at.
We've heard those three points. Look, fair enough, Honourable MacPherson is not here, but I'm sure he had discussions with yourself, Honourable America. No, not on this one. But, I mean, I remember when this was first given to us, it was in the, I think we were in Mark's building at the time. And, of course, he will have the opportunity to speak to it. But let us perhaps hear briefly from yourself then, Ms. Machigari, the CEO of the National Credit Regulator, and Mr. Sipa Mandla, if you wish. Right.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. If we are of the opinion that, or the committee feels that the 450 per thousand would be too expensive for consumers, we could probably look at, you know, a sliding scale. Because, I mean, in any event, we don't foresee these people, you know, having to cover amounts of more than 50,000. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sifamandu.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think mine is to just confirm what the CEO has indicated. I think we are of that view. Although in the current regulations dealing with credit life insurance, we have done the capping. We have given credit providers options. They can either use what we normally call a straight line, meaning the balance remains the same in terms of what you pay per month until the debt is depleted, or you use a declining balance where it goes along with the outstanding amount. Yeah. So thanks.
Those are the comments from Trade and Industry and the National Credit Regulator for us to consider. Remember, we're coming back again tomorrow on the same thing. Keep that in mind. All right. Carry on then, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chief. Okay, so that one we can then go on. I can see where the next one is. We're then dealing with offences, and I just want to get to the clause in the bill. These relate to offences in respect of registration. So the question is whether we should have it as an offence if a person provides credit without being registered, and whether that penalty attached to it. So first off, if you may just speak to 157C, because it is a new section. So what we have here is that any person who offers a service that is made possible by the National Credit Act, and the National Credit Act requires you to be registered in order to deliver that service, and you're not registered, but you are delivering the service, then this section says it is an offence. So that is the thing that we've brought in. In relation to the scope of this bill actually we only need A and B, the credit provider providing credit without being registered. But as we are bringing this section in, I've also gone through the Act and just made sure that all registrations are then included. Now, the question is, we did not include a penalty for this, which means that the Act will apply, and the Act says that if a person commits an offence in terms of this Act, and I'm referring to Section 161 of the Act, paragraph B, it simply says that in any other case, because it now talks about paragraph A person is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 12 months or to both. So the question here is, if we agree that offering a service for which you should be registered and you're not is an offence, should the penalty be 12 months or the equivalent fine or both? Or should we have something more? The other penalties that we provide for, we've made them the same as the administrator fine, which is the greater of your annual turnover or 1 million rand, or not exceeding those amounts. So those are quite more significant, heavier penalties. 12 months, if it is something that goes to a district court, it will be about 4,000 rand. That would be the fine that's equivalent to 12 months. So the question is that for someone who's not registered, is that an appropriate fine? Should we do more? We don't have to go to the annual turnover argument. We could say 5 years, 10 years, and then there will be an equivalent fine in accordance with the Adjustment of Fines Act. So that is the question. Is 12 months enough for someone who offers a service without being registered?
Applying their minds to this, right? Doesn't, I just want to go through this myself. So looking at what the committee report said on page 4, you were saying this is 157C, am I right? On the one hand, plus 161, the penalties, is that right? Just clarify that.
No, this one goes to 157C still. So the question, I'm just, because of this, when we get to 161, we will look at other penalties as well. So I thought I'll just make them both at the one time. So if the agreement is that there should be an offence, should the penalty be 12 months? Because that is currently, in fact, this section is not currently a penalty is not currently provided for in section 161 in relation to this section. So the question is, do we agree it should be an offence? And if it is, should we then accept that 12 months is the penalty, or should we say the penalty should be 5 years up to? It won't be that it must be 5 years or must be 10 years, it will be up to 5 or 10 years.
The point here on page 29, isn't it on page 29 or is it 28?
The clause starts on page 29, so this is where it sets out the offence. And on page 30, subsection 2 then gives a defence for a credit provider who is busy getting his or her credit. But now, we do not provide for a penalty in here, which then means that section 161 of the current Act, paragraph B, applies. So the penalty, if we don't say what the penalty is explicitly, will be a fine or imprisonment or both, and the period should not exceed 12 months.
Right, we're going to put something in this Act specifically which materially differs from the Principal Act. I think that's an important thing because the Principal Act, which I'm looking at here, talks about, a fine or, so you have the option of a fine, not imprisonment, not exceeding 10 years or both. You know, when was this Act 2005, eh? Or 6? trying to look 10 years. I can't recall people being jailed that long for anything. You know, to do anything to do with money, you seem to get away with murder easier. It's what professional recommendation would you make on this, advocate?
Chief, as I understand from the regulator, it is quite a concern, and in fact, this committee has a concern with people offering credit and not being registered because they're not regulated. They definitely do not follow the Act when it comes to enforcing their credit agreement. They venture into the arena of where the police should be getting involved. So if it is something that is that serious and it is really a problem, and keep in mind that this debt intervention that this bill is provided for will not apply to a person who is not a registered credit agreement, a credit provider. And the simple reason for that is because you can't extinguish that debt because they don't follow the law in order to enforce it. They will still come and break your bones if you did not, you know, even if there is an order that says it's extinguished. So this is the seriousness of what we're dealing with here. And it is not exceeding. I don't have a comparison, but my gut feeling would say that 12 months is not enough. I don't think that turnover is appropriate here. I think this is something that should be a jail sentence, or a possible jail sentence. And in that event, I would say nothing less than 5 years.
Just as a matter of principle, I tend to not be a fan of jail sentences for people who have not committed violent crimes which are a danger to society, especially if they can be harmed or if their freedom can be limited in some other way which doesn't impose on the state the burden of them as a prisoner. So I would suggest a much more severe fine that, you know, really puts them in a place where their illegal business is crippled, rather than a jail or some kind of other sentence like a house arrest sentence or something like that, but that's not custodial.
Yes, the one is now jails are really chock-a-block, the prisons, the cost of keeping people there, something else, you know, so there's that side of it, and you may then also wish to retain jail as a last recourse, as you put it, Honourable Hill Lewis, for violence, acts of violence. Yet on the other hand, you know, it's so prevalent that, and arguably has led to, I mean, I saw it argued by someone the other day, well, not the other day, about 2 years ago, that it may even have contributed to some of the challenges and the violence on the mines and that kind of thing. But, again, how do we balance this? I think that's what you're pointing at. How do we achieve it? Yes, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that we should not be naive. When people commit what we could call white-collar crime, there are victims. And these victims, in this case, are going to be the poor people. And if we say, well, you know, that nobody's been hurt, I mean, how do we measure that hurt? Is it not because it's not a physical, violent crime? Perhaps the person commits suicide because of this crime. You know, so I think that we should impose serious fines on this because or serious penalties on this because the outcome for the victims of this crime is quite severe. You know, if you suddenly lose everything or, you know, you've got a problem, you've been misled by some unscrupulous white-collar criminal, and now all he's going to get is a fine, which he can pay because he's going to mislead some more people elsewhere. You know, I think that we should actually put these people in prison because fundamentally we cannot say that if it's a crime that doesn't directly have, you know, blood on his hands, there might be consequences for the victims of these
someone in committee members or yourself, advocate. you know, theft. I've sat waiting in court for someone and heard strange cases of people stealing, you know, as it were, grabbing your purse or breaking into a car or something, taking your purse. They go to jail because very often they can't afford the fine anyway. And, you know, they're given these options. So they sit in jail because they stole 100 rand or 500 rand. I really want to flag this because I think that we must also ensure that there is a balance. What do we want to achieve here? Is it possible to achieve in another way, Honorable Van Schalkwyk?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think this one is really tough because, honestly speaking, if we look at the effects of this unscrupulous behavior on families, on kids, on the broader society, then it can be equal to murder, say for instance, because already a lot of this practice has been going on for such a long time that already a large majority of community members are affected badly. And there needs to be a strong message sent, because due to the fact that this practice has been prevalent for such a long time, those individuals, they are very well off, and they will be able to pay any fine, whichever. So that would not be a strong enough message sent. So I would strongly feel that, Chairperson, that we should look at a harder form of punishment. Because if we say purely about, if we only referring to a fine, it won't be enough. Maybe if we can say, if we look at the extent of the crime, we can either propose a jail sentence or combining a fine with some kind of community service, but not a fine alone. Thank you, Chair.
I think clearly we'll come back to this again. Yes, Mr. Sipa Mandla from DTI.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, this is quite a very difficult area to deal with. Under the Companies Act, we've been sort of inundated with a problem of executives who take decisions on a continuous basis, which severely affects the operation of the company. I mean, you'd remember the issue around the A-bill issue and other issues, you know, and even in general in private sector, executives take decisions and then they don't account for those decisions. For example, the strategy in terms of who to loan to, in terms of numbers and all of that, that's a position that is taken at a strategic level. And people don't just loan unscrupulously and so on and so on. But to address the issue under the Companies Act, we came with the issue of delinquency of directors. But as to whether it's being implemented or not is another issue. But it's something that maybe the committee can look into if it can, to a certain extent, be doable under this particular bill. Because even in the review policy, I think we made reference to the repeated offenders. If we can't come up with, like, criminal prosecution as emphasized by Honorable Lewis, if we can come up with maybe an alternative delinquency and also blacklisting of executives who actually take decisions that affect consumers in that space. Thank you.
Yes, that issue is being taken up more and more internationally. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to maybe, I think the way maybe that I talked about the penalty, I talked about it in a very, very legalistic way, and that might have caused some confusion. I'm putting up on the screen what we are proposing or the proposal for other types of offences. So So the idea is not that the person will, that the judge or the magistrate will impose 10 years. The idea is that the Criminal Procedure Act provides a number of possible judgments. So one of the judgments would then possibly be jail sentence. Now, in a bill, in legislation, we indicate the extent of the fine either through the like we're doing there, a 10% of annual turnover, or we give a year for imprisonment. That gives the judge or the magistrate an idea of the extent of the fine that would be imposed if it is not a jail sentence that is decided on. In addition, the judge or the magistrate can make an order for house arrest, for certain, I'm not calling it community service, but that's not correctional supervision, and there might be some community service requirements. So that is just the maximum that can be, but all the other orders that the Criminal Procedure Act provide for would still be possible. So that is what I was proposing. So I'm just saying that it would not be sufficient to make it 12 months. With 12 months, the fine is 4,000 rand. That is nothing. It's really not something. So on 10 years, you're looking at much higher. And in fact, this you're looking at like to the extent of where the magistrate's courts can go. So in respect of the delinquency, because I have looked at that, The only thing is that the Companies Act already provides for that. So if it is something that is an offence here, the Companies Act will then kick in. And then those sections will come into play. So in other words, it already applies. So if it is a company that has committed this offence and it has been committed twice, then the persons, the directors in that company will be declared delinquent and they will never be able to be a director of a company again. So it's not necessary for us to bring it in here. The thing that I have on the clause that I have up on there, the provision that I'm making, and this would be more or less what I'm proposing, I'm not sure if 10 years is the right one. 5 is probably more applicable to failure to register. But If the person is a company, so in other words, the person who with the credit provider becomes clever and he realizes, oh my shucks, I'm now going to be sentenced to jail, so I better set up a company for myself, and then it's the company who gives the credit and it's not me and I can get away with it, then we catch them as well there, and then we're looking at 10% of annual turnover and that kind of fine.
You know, as you say, you're following tried and tested principles in this regard. We may just want to think overnight on it. But, because the two issues that have come up has been if this is not a violent crime, and then there's a difference in the committee as to what violence actually constitutes. Is it physical or is it mental or whatever? So I think let's keep that in, think about it overnight and come back tomorrow morning. Just as we move towards the closure of this particular section, we will be needing to take a firm decision tomorrow, and I'm trying to see who's going to be here. What time is the meeting tomorrow? 8:30, is it? Because it's the panelists, etc. You remember for copyright. And people have had a long time now. They've had 3 weeks on this. So we've got to take a decision, and we need, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, we can, but I think fair enough, let's just go back fresh and consult our parties just on the matter and be certain that we come here. That is with the names, and we've had it on the table for 3 weeks, so there's nothing new. Are we all happy with that position? We do that tomorrow morning, all right? Just coming back to this then, I think that was the penalties, wasn't it? And then we come to the subcommittee number 21, clause 23.
Both the last two questions on this report both relate to penalties, and the question is simply, does the committee agree with the penalty? So I've again split the screen. It's a bit difficult to read, but okay. So if we look at the offence the new section 157A creates, that is when you submit false information in your application for debt intervention, or you present your information in a way that is intended to mislead the regulator or the tribunal. And in that instance, the penalty that I'm proposing there is a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 10 years. So it's quite serious. But I don't know if the committee feels 10 years is appropriate. Perhaps for the consumer, thinking about who we're dealing with, 5 years maximum should perhaps be the most that we go to. It is serious, because if it is someone who is selling all his or her assets, and I think it was Ms. van Schalkwyk who gave me the example of someone who, in order to qualify, they earn very little, or they can show that they earn very little because their income is actually somewhere else, so they qualify for the 7.5. Then they have this big house of furniture. They quickly sell that to a company or whatever. They take that money and they pop it into an annuity. Now they have actually sidestepped. They qualify, they've sidestepped. That kind of person is who we are looking at here. So that is what, there might be lesser misleadings, and then it could be a lesser fine. It doesn't have to be the 10 years. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be jail. It can just be a fine. But so if we look at that, because that is what we need to keep in mind, the worst case scenario, what would we want that person to get? And then this is where we need to look at the maximum. Should it be 10 years? Should it be 5 years? So that is the question there.
Chairperson, one of the things we had a problem with this section on what we're going to do with people who basically lie on their application,
yeah,
is if you're applying for debt relief, the chances of you paying then a fine because you blundered is going to be quite reduced, because you won't have the resources to pay for a fine. But I'm also saying, I don't know, there will be a few people that will be manipulating the system, and those people should get harsh sentences. But in general, I think there might be individuals who might not necessarily deserve a prison sentence of 10 years for applying for a 5,000 rand debt relief. So we have to really look at it. Perhaps one of the things we can put in here is that you'll never be allowed to apply for debt relief ever again if you lie on your form, and perhaps a small fine. But it depends on how much money they're applying for, because if they're applying for a full 50,000 rands and they're trying to wangle, get 50, you know, it depends what they're looking at. So maybe it should be the discretion of the tribunal.
You've raised an important point. Let's flag that you and the professor, I mean, you can hear what has been raised here as well. And keeping in mind what we've already agreed upon, that the discretion, the tribunal having a, looking at case by case, as it were, and having that objectivity, you may well be in a better position on the case by case. And sometimes I ask myself, do people always understand what it is they signing on these forms? You know, you can meet professors who can't fill in forms. It seems to be an acquired skill. And, you know, you genuinely have misunderstood something and you sign for it. And I think it's important that however we draft and craft such applications for debt relief must be accessible. People must understand what it is and what it means. So, and a case in point is the South Africanism of, I'll come just now, and you say that to an overseas person, and they get very upset because you take 2 hours. They said, but I told you just now. Yeah, well, you know, that should mean, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. It's our understanding of what is the same word in each of our different cultures, as it were. So I do hope that this is going to be a very, very accessible form, and that people can readily fill it in and understand it. But I think we've reached a point, I believe we have, Advocate van der Merwe, where we have looked at this report, we've examined it from the subcommittee, we've got a couple of flags still that we need to come back to, I hope everyone acknowledges that, and we've also said that tomorrow we'll do the panel final decisions on that one. But I must say, in choosing a panel, let us never forget, it's not that you can't add to the panel at some point, but it means this is definitely the core group that we need to go along with. So let's keep that in mind. And this was meant to help us, am I not right? You know, this list here that you've got two page, as well as, of course, on another page, I think it is 173-odd stakeholders, although there may be one or two folks here that have not directly made a submission. But what we're looking at are, you know, not just academically, if you like, but geographically and right across the board to try and get a representative panel. And it's been such a comprehensive thing, copyright. Look, from broadcasting right through to tribunals, disabilities, etc., that we may not have them all along. Say for someone from Braille or something. They may not necessarily have to come to every single meeting, but there may be a point where they would absolutely have to make themselves available. So do take that seriously. I'm looking at yourself now, Mr. Hermans. It would appear as if we have completed the work we wanted to complete today, and I'm sorry we didn't allow more time for deliberations, but I think we've done sufficient, and it does mean then that we are able to adjourn early until tomorrow morning at 8:30 E249. Before people leave, and this is for the visitors, you know, I want to remind everyone here that there's some documents which are really only for the committee at a particular point in time. There's nothing secret in Parliament, but the danger is that sometimes people take a document which is very much a working draft, crafted, operational document. The next thing, you're reading it in the paper, is this is the committee document. And it really does mislead the public. So we're appealing to everyone, unless you are told, help yourself, you should refrain from simply helping yourself to whatever is lying around. On the question of lobbying in principle is not allowed by the Constitution. It's not disallowed. But I think what is important for those of you who come from different sectors of society here is that you are aware that it is the committee members whom you may speak with who have to apply their minds. When this court, if this bill ever had to go to the Constitutional Court won't be calling in one of the guests, did you apply your mind? Oh no. They'll be calling in one of the members sitting here, who may well not even remember how on earth they got to that point. Because they never did get to that point. They were given the information. So by all means, engage. All means. But when you've engaged, make